the Senate Judiciary Committee meeting together to order. Today is the 17th of February. It's about 1:35, 1:36. We have Senator Meyer, Senator Wilkowski, and Senator Coghill here. The other two have been noted that they may not be here today. One is excused from the call of the Senate today. Today, the deal is to bring up Senate Bill 54. It is the bill that is that I've personally sponsored, that is meant to take on some of the substantive revisions of Senate Bill 91 that were recommended to us by the Criminal Justice Commission. They found their way into the bill. It took us a little drafting expertise to get here. I think there's still some things we need to carry out, but I wanted to make sure we introduced it. All the policy calls are in here that I think need to be in here, and there might be some tune-up language. In your packet, before we begin, just so that you can follow a little bit, is I have, this is for my information, I call it my cheat sheet. It's the bill contents. It actually outlines a policy, and I don't know if people have it, but I think it looks like this, and it's meant to be a way of showing what section in the bill and what recommendation the Criminal Justice Commission works. So when you see the word REC, it was based on the recommendation from the Criminal Justice Commission. And what I'd like to do today is just kind of roll it out. We can ask top-level questions, but as we get into more details, or if there's something that's not easily understood at a high-end rollout, then we'll ask questions. Online, I have Department of Law, John Skidmore, Public Defender, Renee McFarland, available for questions. And what I thought I'd do is have Jordan Schilling, who's my staff member on this and the committee staff aide, to go ahead and introduce it, roll through it. You'll see if you follow both the sectional and the bill content summary sheet, you'll see that the big policy calls are fairly easily lined out in order. Mr. Schilling, why don't you just go ahead and introduce yourself and introduce this bill to us.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. So just going through the bill sections in order, we could start with sections 1 and 2, which have the effect of making violation of conditions of release a criminal offense rather than a violation. In 2015, the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission recommended that violation of conditions of release be downgraded to an arrestable, detainable violation. And this recommendation was, of course, enacted through Senate Bill 91 last year. However, implementation did not go immediately as the commission intended. And so while SB 91 included an arrest provision so that VCOR offenders could be arrested, some of those arrested were not being held in jail because judges did not feel that they had the authority to hold the defendant pending a bail review or until the judge in the underlying case could review bail. So the commission has recommended making VCOR a criminal offense again. And if we just look at the
violations of conditions of release, just without using the acronym as much as possible, for those who are watching, especially my dad who's watching this, I want him to follow this. Just for what it's worth, committee members and for those interested in what we're doing here, on the commission recommendations, they tried to follow practices that were data-driven, and there's several things that they tried to follow: the need for rehabilitation, sufficiency of state resources, the effect of the rate of recidivism based on laws, and then peer-reviewed data. And that would have been metadata, not individual case data. But most of these recommendations are going to fall into other categories that they were called upon to entertain, and that is the need to confine offenders to prevent public harm or to keep public safety, and then the deterrence of offenders, and then the public condemnation. And all of those came out loud and clear. So this violations of conditions of release was both the police and the public coming very clearly to us with some concerns. So I just wanted to kind of set that stage again. My apologies for interrupting you, Mr. Jordan.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. For the record again, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. So The commission ultimately recommended that violation of conditions of release be made a B misdemeanor. And so if you look at sections 1 and 2 of the bill, section 1 is really conforming to the fact that we're making violation of conditions of release a misdemeanor again. Simply changes the word offense to crime, because offense can include non-criminal things like violations and infractions. And section 2 has the effect of making it a Class B misdemeanor instead of a violation punishable by up to $1,000.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
I certainly agree that there's times when it should be a Class B misdemeanor, but is this punishing every violation if someone shows up 5 minutes, you know, gets in a car accident and can't meet with their probation officer, for example? Is there any exceptions? Because I think there were some good policy reasons for what we were trying to do, and I'm wondering if there's a way to craft this so that the more egregious ones are violations and the ones that are more egregious are Class B misdemeanors. Have you given any thought to that?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. As it is written now, it would treat all of those convicted of violation of conditions of release the same. It doesn't delineate between some conditions and other conditions. And it is true that the commission did weigh some different approaches to resolving this administrative problem other than simply making it a criminal offense again. So I think that there probably are some other options, and I know the commission weighed some of those. Ultimately, though, they did recommend that this be made a criminal offense again.
And just as the sponsor of the bill, and as since we've all dealt with this for a couple of years now, as always, if you could think of recommendations that you think would be given some flexibility to the courts but still end up at a B misdemeanor if they need it, I think I'm open to that discussion for what it's worth.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
I would,
Senator Meyer.
I would concur with Senator Wilkowski. I think some flexibility is needed there if we can.
And when it's our turn to get this bill back in front of us, what we'll do is we'll probably ask how that might be flexible now or inflexible. So for those, I know John Skidmore is listening, and so is Renee McFarland. You want to go through the bill, or do you want to go ahead and have them address this while we're going through it? Because they're each different policy calls.
Yeah, we can come back to it, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Anyway, just flag that for further comment. So, Mr. Schilling.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. So, Sections 3 and 4 are very complex, and I have John Skidmore on the line to help me if there's any questions about the language. But just to give a little bit of history on the sex trafficking conversation that the legislature's had over the past couple years. So the sex trafficking provisions in this bill are intended to resolve what Department of Law has pointed out to be a loophole that was inadvertently created by the passage of Senate Bill 91. So the history on this is that there was a standalone bill in the other body last year, HB 349. And HB 349 was intended to prevent the felonization of types of prostitution that did not rise to the level of what we commonly think of as sex trafficking. HB 349 was intended to ensure that sex workers simply working together, not exploiting one another, could not be prosecuted for trafficking each other or trafficking themselves. However, as passed, those provisions created a loophole that effectively allowed sex traffickers to could allow sex traffickers to avoid prosecution for lower degrees of sex trafficking. And so the provisions that create the loophole that I just discussed are actually repealed later in the bill in Section 15. And so the loophole has been repealed, but Sections 3 and 4 that are in the bill before you intend to strike that same balance that HB 349 was intended without that inadvertent loophole created. So the commission also recommended that the legislature define the term compensation. The commission did not give explicit language for the legislature to use. So our office has solicited feedback and asked for help from the Department of Law and the Department and the Public Defender to draft us a definition for compensation to consider.
which we have not gotten to date, but we're still having an email trail on that. So that will also come before the committee, so there's something to flag.
So Section 5, Mr. Chairman, under current law, an individual with no prior felonies on their record who is convicted of a Class C felony receives a presumptive sentence of up to 18 months of felony probation supervision. Of course, if an aggravator is proven, that individual can be sentenced up to 5 years in prison, but of course the presumptive sentence is just felony supervision up to 18 months. And the purpose of that provision, which was recommended by the Commission and enacted by Senate Bill 91, was to provide community supervision for these first-time felony offenders and to allow that offender to maintain pro-social ties to the community and to ensure that that offender was also complying with their conditions while in the community. However, the Commission heard a number of concerns from prosecutors, the public in general, that there ought to be some presumptive active imprisonment for these felony offenders, regardless of them being first time or not. So what this section of the bill does is it removes the provision that requires probation for these first time felony offenders and requires 0 to 90 days, and in addition to the 0 to 90 days of active imprisonment, a suspended term of imprisonment up to 18 months.
And just for the committee and for those watching in, this was debated somewhat in the Criminal Justice Committee. There were a variety of different things to look at. So you'll see in my little cheat sheet that I've passed out, that is recommendation number 5 in the Commission, and I would encourage you to go back and read what they recommended, because that's probably going to be something we're going to be dealing with in substance. But I wanted you to know the original rationale for how we got to that language.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Wilkowski and then Senator Meyer.
I had a constituent contact me about the first-time DUI offense. What is the penalty under SB 91 for first-time DUI offense, and is that being changed at all with this?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, first-time DUI is an A misdemeanor, and this statute addresses C felony sentences. So the sentence for first-time DUI, I believe, is 3 days minimum active imprisonment. I believe 30 in total can be imposed, but what's generally imposed in Alaska is 27 suspended with 3 active.
Senator Meyer? Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, just follow up on that.
Did we change that with Senate Bill 91? Can you just refresh my memory on that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we did not change the number of days through Senate Bill 91, but we required that that individual serve the first DUI 3-day minimum on electronic monitoring with home confinement.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the answer, Mr. Schilling. Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So let me see if I understand this correctly. A first-time felony conviction of a Class C felony is 0 to 90 days imprisonment?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, this bill is proposing providing up to 90 days of prison. But without this bill, under current law, that individual would serve up to 18 months on felony supervision on probation.
And Mr. Chairman, so this still doesn't guarantee a imprisonment, correct? It just could be imprisonment up to 3 months.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, that is absolutely the case, although I should note that even prior to the passage of Senate Bill 91, a zero-day sentence was imposable by the court. The range for a C felony with no priors prior to Senate Bill 91 was 0 to 2 years.
Mr. Chairman, we can just discuss this more, but I think when I asked an example of a Class C felony, it could be someone who was shooting at you with a gun, but just doesn't hit you.
Right.
And I'm just thinking that I really don't want anybody shooting at anybody, regardless if they hit them or not.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So there is a range in a C felony that we should probably talk about, but the discussion in the Criminal Justice Commission was how to have violent, nonviolent, but that was a very tough thing to get to. And so then it was what the range, and then an imprisonment that was 0 to 90 days was enough to maybe get 18 months of this suspended imprisonment hanging over their head to get them into some corrective action. So it could be monitoring. So that's how we got it structured here. I don't know if it's a perfect structure at this point, but that's what we were thinking, and that was following along the lines generally of the recommendation of the commission, notwithstanding the debate on both sides, because some thought it was a little too much, some thought it was a little too little.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Schilling.
Would you like me to move to the next section, Mr.
Yes,
Chairman?
Please.
Okay, so Section 6 requires a minimum term of probation for felony sex offenders. I can give a little bit of history on this, Mr.
Please
Chairman.
Do.
So in 2015, the commission recommended new probation term limits. And what the commission recommended was a limit of 5 years probation for a felony sex offender and 3 years for all other felony offenders. And there was already a statute in place at the time that required a minimum of 15 years probation for a felony sex offender. And because that 15-year minimum statute conflicted with the new probation term lengths in the originally introduced Senate Bill 91, because we had two statutes that conflicted, that conflicting statute was removed. Over time, the 5-year probation term limit increased from 5 years to 10 years in the Senate. Then when the bill moved over to the other body, it increased again from 10 to 15 years. And so at the point when it was raised to 15 years, I suppose the House could have then resurrected that statute that was originally repealed and put it back in place. For whatever reason, oversight or otherwise, that provision was not put back into law. And so what the commission has recommended, and while the commission has not heard it being a problem and has not heard of a felony sex offender who has not had a term of probation imposed, still felt that it was prudent to require it in law so that that could not happen. So while this bill does not to simply replace the previous statute that contains the minimums, it seems that this committee could either allow this to stand as is or determine their own unique minimums for felony sex offenders.
But at this point, what we're saying is there should be an imposition of a mandatory probation.
Yes, at least some.
All right. And that would give a lot of discretion to both the parole board and judges.
Senator Cockhill, what this would allow is a term of probation, as I read it, for a felony sex offender from 1 day up to 15 years.
Okay. I just wanted to get a range on that, so thank you.
So Section 7 is the A misdemeanor recommendation made by the Commission. SB 91 enacted a presumptive sentence for most Class A misdemeanors of 0 to 30 days. There were exceptions, of course. For example, assault can be sentenceable up to a year, even if it's your first assault. And, of course, there were also some sex offenses that were exempted from the 0 to 30-day provision and are sentenceable up to a year. But prosecutors, even so, voiced some concern about the escalator to get to a year for those other misdemeanors requiring two previous convictions rather than just one previous conviction. So for those A misdemeanors that aren't exempted from the 0 to 30 policy, it would look like this. You'd commit your first A misdemeanor, you'd get 0 to 30 days. Your second A misdemeanor would be 0 to 30 days. Upon the third, you could get up to a year. So what the commission has recommended is an intermediate escalator whereby your first would be 0 to 30, your second for that same offense would be 0 to 60, and then your third would be 0 to a year. So I could walk the committee through the language if you'd like, Mr. Chairman. On page 3, line 28, specifies that the aggravator to get up to the year requires two or more convictions. And on the next page, page 4, line 9 through 11, is what creates the 0 to 60 range for someone with one previous conviction for that similar offense.
Seeing no questions, we move on.
So Section 8 of the bill is a continuation of the violation of condition of release recommendation. This is the language that provides for up to 5 days of active imprisonment for violation of conditions of release.
All right.
Section 9 of the bill addresses two of the recommendations that the commission made with respect to theft in the fourth degree. Theft in the fourth degree refers to items stolen valued at $250 or less, $0 to $250. So the first recommendation that's enacted through this section is to clarify the length of probation allowed for first and second convictions of theft 4. The commission recommended and Senate Bill 91 intended to provide up to 6 months of probation for a second and first time conviction for theft in the fourth degree. However, those specific provisions in this part of the law were actually silent on the term length of probation that could be imposed. And while it was the thought of many that judges and practitioners would refer to another section of law, a general statute that provides probation term length limits, there's a legal principle that requires us to place the probation term length limit in this specific statute rather than hope that magistrates and judges refer on other parts of the law. So this explicitly says that a six-month term of probation can be imposed for first and second time theft for offenders. Now the second thing that this section does, the more substantive thing, is provides for up to 10 days of active imprisonment for a third theft 4 conviction. This is a deviation from Senate Bill 91 and the Commission's recommendations last year, which provided for simply 5 days of suspended imprisonment for a third conviction, third and subsequent conviction of theft 4.
And I think that's going to be a discussion. First of all, I think we should see a list of these misdemeanors in a context because there's a range. And then secondly, we're going to see how the various different departments see this in their fiscal note. It's not data driven, but it's driven by people that are just so tired of being stolen from that they wanted some time to hang over there of the head to change behavior. So, but whether this is exactly right or not, or if there's a flex point in here that needs to happen, I'm still open to discussion on that. This is a commission recommendation, and I would encourage you to look at their recommendations, both 2 and 9, to get the context of this. All right.
And Mr. Chairman, and I know you know this, but just for the benefit of the commission or the committee, there are some drafting things that could be clarified and perhaps a potential future CS.
Yes. But that's what we found when we started looking at the implementation practice, the actual verbiage to make sure it was right. There's a couple of places that we saw that we're going to have to do better. So no, not changing any substance, it's just changing how it works. So, all right, Mr. Schilling.
Mr. Chairman, Section 10 and 11 are conforming sections, their continuation of the sex trafficking changes. Because we moved around some of the subsections within sex trafficking in the third and fourth degree statutes, that renumbering has required two conforming sections to accommodate for the fact that there are new numbers on some of those subsections.
Okay.
Section 12, and this is not only a commission recommendation but a priority of the municipality of Anchorage, Senate Bill 91 placed a limitation on the level of punishments that municipalities could have. Senate Bill 91 required that municipalities could not have a greater punishment for a similar offense under state law. And what this language has inadvertently done is this has been interpreted to apply to offenses that aren't criminal offenses. And it was never intended, the Commission or Senate Bill 91 did not intend to place a limit on the types of punishments that municipalities could have for traffic infractions and violations and offenses and ordinances like that or in regulations. And so by removing the word offense and specifying that we're talking about a crime, would allow the municipality to have its own unique punishments for infractions and violations.
Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So a DUI, where would that fall in this? Because I've heard that some municipalities want to have a tougher DUI law than, say, the state of Alaska. Would that be possible?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, they could not have a term of imprisonment that's greater. And I think that as this reads now, it maybe could be left to interpretation whether the municipality could have a greater fine for that criminal offense. And then there is also a discussion I've heard about forfeitures and impounding vehicles. For example, in Anchorage, a first-time DUI, and I'm not an expert on this, but I know that under the Anchorage ordinances, a first-time DUI causes one to lose their vehicle and have to get it out of impoundment later. Under state law, we don't reserve that punishment until your second DUI. And so it may be that this committee wants to further define what punishment means in order to give clarity to the way the muni would respond to fines and impoundment and things that we don't normally think of as standard jail punishments.
So this is where I think we'll solicit some input from the prosecutors in both. There's three municipalities that have this issue before them. Juneau and Anchorage probably being probably the most active. So I'm open to discussion on this. I just haven't seen any language yet that I was willing to put in, but I'm sure open to discussion. And as we go through this, you might just have your Anchorage people, or if they're on listening in on this, if they have any specific issues that they think might give them that flex point, I'm open to discussion. Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, help me understand, too. Does the municipality of Anchorage, for example, do they have a choice of charging somebody with a state law versus a local law? And if they use the state law, then does the state pick up the costs, the court costs?
I am no expert.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I know that the Department of Law can screen cases in a way that require the municipality to pursue prosecution. I don't know all the nuances to that. And I know that the director of the criminal division, Mr. Skidmore, is on the line, and I know he would know the answer to that.
Do you want to go ahead and pursue an answer to that?
Yes.
Mr. Skidmore, have you been listening to the conversation and the question?
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is John Skidmore. I'm the director of the criminal division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. Through the chair, Senator Meyer, the answer to your question is that the law enforcement agency, which in the case of Anchorage would be the Anchorage Police Department, has the discretion to decide whether or not they want to refer a case to the municipal prosecutor or to the state prosecutors. When it is referred to either agency, that agency would screen it under the authorizing legislation. For the state, that's a state statute that you all have passed. For the municipality, that's the municipal code that the assembly has passed. We at law do not have the ability to screen out a case and insist that the muni take it. The municipality does not have the ability to screen out a case and insist that the state takes it. What either agency can do is simply decline to prosecute, and if the other agency wants to pick it up, they could, but neither agency can force the other one to do anything. I hope that's responsive to your question, sir.
Senator Meyer?
Yeah, I think it does. I guess my concern is, as budgets get tighter for both the local governments and the state government, certainly, is there an opportunity to do some cost shifting here? In other words, if APD picks up somebody for a DUI and then they decide to use the state law for that particular case, then does the cost automatically shift to the state versus the municipality?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, if the case is referred to the state as opposed to the municipality, then the state bears the cost of that prosecution. If the case is referred to the municipality, then the municipality bears the cost for that prosecution and as well some cost then for any incarceration that might follow. So that's always been the way that it worked. And those are things, those are issues that were various prosecution entities attempt to coordinate and talk with one another and with local law enforcement so that we have some general guidance on how things will flow. But yes, your question is, could someone try and shift costs in that way? The answer is yes, they could. That's always been a possibility.
Mr. Skidmore, just for some parameter on that, it's my understanding that the municipality prosecutes misdemeanors but not felonies. Am I right in my thinking?
Yes, Senator Cargill, you are correct that both the municipality of Anchorage and the municipality of Juneau have enacted municipal codes that allow them to prosecute misdemeanors. There's no one in the state that prosecutes felony conduct other than the state of Alaska, unless you go to federal charges under federal law, which of course would be handled by the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to have that context brought up as well.
But, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Meyer?
But it's my understanding that DUI is, as you mentioned, misdemeanor A?
Yeah.
Unless it's your second or third time, I suppose.
Yeah.
Third time?
The third time is a felony DUI.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Appreciate it. Mr. Schilling?
Again, for the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Cargo. And just to clarify, Senator Meyer, third DUI in 10 years is your first felony DUI.
Okay, thank you.
So Section 13 deals with the Department of Corrections requirement to conduct pretrial risk assessments. So when Senate Bill 91's pretrial provisions go into effect in about a year, January 1st, 2018, the Department of Corrections is required to conduct a pretrial risk assessment on all defendants, regardless of whether they're in custody or not. However, the purpose of this assessment is to inform judges in making a release decision, inform judges and pretrial services officers. And because not all defendants will actually be in custody pretrial, for example, an individual who has been released on the bail schedule or an individual who has been issued a citation rather than a physical arrest, it's unclear how or even why that defendant would receive a pretrial risk assessment. And so the Department of Corrections approached the commission. The commission deliberated on this and recommended that pretrial risk assessments be limited only to those defendants who are in custody or all defendants, any defendant, if requested by prosecution.
All right. Thank you. I think that pretty well nailed it.
Section 14 is conforming to the sex trafficking changes, just to accommodate for the renumbering that's occurring in sections 3. Section 15 is the repealer section, and we just talked about earlier in the discussion the inadvertent loophole created with respect to sex trafficking. That loophole is being repealed. That's 1166-130B and 1166-135B. Now, the three other things in the repealer section in 1255-125 are being repealed pursuant to one of the commission's recommendations that all felony DUI sentencing statutes be contained in one title. Right now, because of the passage of Senate Bill 91, the felony DUI sentencing statutes are in two different titles, Title 11 and simultaneously Title 28. Practitioners would prefer some clarity in that they would like all of the sentencing provisions to be in one place. And so that is why these are being repealed out of Title 12, but are still contained in Title 28.
Any questions on that?
Section 16 are the applicability provisions, Mr. Chairman, and 17 and 18 are the effective dates.
And Section 13 says, Section 17 says Section 13 of this act takes.
That's right, Mr.
Effect.
Chairman. That is the pretrial risk assessment section, and because Senate Bill 91's pretrial provisions don't go into effect until January 1st, 2018, we do not need that provision to go into effect until then as well.
All right. I just wanted to bring that to everybody's attention. So that's generally the bill, committee members. And What we can do, if you want, we can leave it at that, or you can ask questions. We have Mr. Skidmore and Renee McFarland online. This is probably a good time to find out if you want to drill down into something, or we can certainly wait, because this is not going to be the first time this bill will be before us. And as you can see, violation of conditions of release, the C felony, the theft in the fourth degree, and the municipal penalty really are the four big questions that I think this bill will try to answer. The sex trafficking, as complex as it is, it's really trying to make sure that that, you know, prostitution already has its own crime, but trafficking is a very, very different approach, and they wanted to say if they're sharing some resources, and we'll probably have to come up with a definition for what that sharing that is, that they're not actually sex trafficking. So though it's not a commission recommendation, though it's something I never thought in my wildest dreams I'd be dealing with, the fact is the House did put it in, and we passed it in Senate Bill 91, and it's something that we need to make sure is done well. So is there any questions from the committee at this point? Do you want to entertain Mr. Skidmore or Renee McFarland, or we can just take these notes and go from there? And I did forget to tell people to turn their phones off, but the guy you just ran out, I can't pick on right now. Well, that could make for a really short Friday afternoon meeting. At least you got to see the layout of the bill, and I wanted the general public to see that some of the questions that had come to us first are not easily quantified as far as data-driven, but they're definitely easy to quantify as far as public safety from the police and public outcry and just trying to make things work better in our law. My intention is not to make this a bill that grows but tries to get narrower to the things that need to be fixed first and most dramatically. So I'm not going to try to do any omnibus bill this year, committee members. But this is just to answer the questions that people felt very, very strongly about from the passage of Senate Bill 91. And I think they're appropriate, and they're the places where the greatest consternation has arisen. So thank you, Mr. Schilling. Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, and as you said, we'll have more time to talk about this, but I guess I'm still a little concerned about the Class C felonies, and that there is some way to separate the violent from the nonviolent, and that the violent are treated more harshly than the nonviolent. And I'm not sure we're quite there yet. I think what you're saying, by having a range from 0 to, was it 90?
Right now it's 90, yes.
You know, that hopefully the judge would say, okay, this was a violent act. Somebody was actually shooting at somebody, could have killed him. So I'm going to give him 30 days in jail. But as it is, the judge could still not give him any prison time. So I don't know. I'll have to wrestle with that. I'm sure we'll be talking more about it.
No doubt. And if you go back and read the record from the Criminal Justice Commission, you'll see the Department of Law, at one point we're thinking, how do you separate nonviolent and violent? They also talked about having a broader, longer range. And that might be something that, as we go through the deliberation, the only thing I don't want to do is start doing a bidding war on where we think is the most, put it this way, we'll bump right up against the next felony level if we are not careful, and we lose the benefit of actually changing somebody else's behavior. So that's why we put in there the 18 months on some kind of a reporting, probationary reporting. That probably could be done better. It's not as artful as it could be written. I'll be open to that discussion. But you'll see the Department of Law felt that they were thinking 12 months is probably a little more appropriate, and that might give a range of from the most egregious to the least egregious. So we can have that conversation, and Mr. Skidmore will certainly be glad to show you what a C felony is generally, and why he thinks that range is. but we'll also talk to the public defender on why they think that that may not be as appropriate. Okay. But I would encourage you to read the discussion that happened in the commission, because it was probably one of the most talked about issues in the commission.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, if I may,
sure.
The other concern, of course, and we talked about this last time a little bit, was the Class B misdemeanors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with the folks that are breaking into people's houses and cars and or even going into Denny's while you're eating and getting robbed. I know that's Section 7 and 9. I haven't read it thoroughly, but what? So first time for a Class B misdemeanor is what again? What's
the Section 7 was the A misdemeanors, and that was an aggravator that could be added to the A misdemeanor. But the B misdemeanors were the theft in the fourth degree. That's Section 9.
Okay.
Mr. Schilling.
Mr. Chairman, for the record again, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. Section 9 is where we deal with theft in the fourth degree and things that are similar to theft in the fourth degree, removal of ID marks, unlawful possession, issuing a bad check, criminal simulation. And what this envisions is up to 10 days of active imprisonment for your third conviction. The robbery scenario is a felony. Burglary is a felony. What we're talking about here is theft of items under $250.
Under $250. So if I break into your house and steal up to $500 worth of jewelry, then that's what's the penalty for that?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, so not an expert. Breaking into someone's house, though, is burglary. And I believe if someone else is involved, then it's robbery. And if burglary and robbery were not involved, but we were just talking about $500 that you just described, that would be an A misdemeanor. Thefts between $250 and $1,000 is A misdemeanor theft.
And since Jordan Schilling is not a lawyer, if you want to ask Mr. Skidmore?
Sure, if we have time, Mr. Chairman.
John, are you still available, and did you hear the question?
Through the chair, this is John Skidmore from the Criminal Division Department of Law. Senator Meyer, Jordan Schilling has answered your question accurately. If the individual breaks into another person's home with the intent to steal something when they break in, that's a burglary in the first degree, which is a Class B felony. If you are stealing the property from another person that is off of their person, and you're doing that through force or threat, that's actually considered a robbery. But if you're just talking about theft of property that's not from breaking into somebody's home and that's not being taken from their person through force, that's strictly a theft. And again, Mr. Schilling is correct that a theft under $250 is a Class B misdemeanor called theft in the fourth. Between $250 and $1,000 would be a Class A misdemeanor, which would be theft in the third.
Okay, appreciate that. And what we're hearing about a lot, unfortunately, in Anchorage, is some of these, Mr. Chairman, if I may?
Yes, please continue, Mr. Senator Meyer.
Okay, is some of these gadget electronic device stores are getting broken into frequently. So breaking into a store versus breaking into someone's home, is that still just still considered a robbery?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, the answer is no. Breaking into a building other than a residence is a burglary in the second degree as opposed to the first degree, and that would be a Class C felony. So breaking into the store to steal some electronic device, Class C felony, that's the discussion that Senator Coghill outlined for you, that we'd be talking, should that person receive probation, should there be a possibility of some jail time, and if so, what's the range that the court ought to be allowed to consider under those circumstances. If the electronic device is in someone's purse or in the back pocket, and the person walks up and slips it out of the back pocket or slips it out of the purse, that's not a robbery because it's not done through force, and it would just be a theft. And then the question becomes, what is the value of that device?
Okay. And
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how do you value that device, the purchase price or the fair market value price or black market price?
Through the chair, that's an excellent question, Senator Meyer, and there are statutes, it's in 1146, if you give me just a moment, I'll turn to the right one, that says how do you determine the value of property, and I believe it's generally deemed to be the fair market value of that, but give me just one moment. It's Alaska Statute 1146980, and it says whenever necessary to determine the value of property, that value is the market value of the property at the time and place of the crime unless otherwise specified, or if the market value cannot reasonably be ascertained, then the cost of replacement of the property within a reasonable time after the crime.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, I think Senator Wilkowski, also coming from Anchorage, has probably heard the same frustration that as stores and homes are getting broken into, that I don't know if it's the police department or who has been kind of referring to Senate Bill 91 as having taken any punishment or any force of enforcement away from them, and I think they were frustrated in that nothing was being done to these folks that were kind of a revolving door, constantly just robbing one house and getting their hands slapped and going to the next house. So, and I know the problem is much bigger than just punishment. There's a serious opioid problem in our city as well as statewide and probably nationwide, but still we got to figure out a way of deterring people from randomly breaking into homes and hopefully businesses being able to have a storefront and not have to worry about it getting broken into every other month. So.
Yeah. And Senator Meyer and Senator Wilkowski and the Department of Law and Public Defenders, this bill, in my view, must get across and get out to both the public and the police, only because there has to be a restoration of confidence in the police to do their work. But it's also in the context of budget crunches where public prosecutors and defenders, the ability to prosecute, the police are feeling the crunch of how many police they can get on the street at any one given time, noticing that almost every community is dealing with people thieving to fuel a drug habit. I mean, there's people that are just thieves for other reasons, but the main push right now is because of drugs. So they have to have tools, and then it's just a matter of the magnitude of the tool. And so these, I think, were the tools that came to us very, very clearly. There are many others, probably. I mean, the governor just declared an opioid epidemic and is going to take on whatever he can do. But our part is to make sure that both the police, the prosecutors, and the public have confidence that the tools are there. And so as we look at the C felony issue, I think it's probably, as Mr. Skidmore said, one that has given probably some of the greatest consternation. And then both the A misdemeanor and the fourth degree B misdemeanors and theft are wearying people because there seems to be almost a scoff law on petty theft. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to ramp these tools up.
And
Senator Meyer, and then I'll get to Senator Wilkowski.
Okay, I'm sorry, this is just my last comment, is that we haven't seen a fiscal note yet with Senate Bill 54, but
that's true.
But I'm sure, obviously, whenever you increase the enforcement and the penalty, it increases the cost. And I know Senate Bill 91 initially was intended to save the state money, and I believe it still will, even with these changes that you're suggesting. But it will be interesting to see how much more this is going to cost us.
The intention was for public safety. I'm only going to say that because it's been quite often misconstrued that it was meant to save the state money. that was meant to save us criminal activity and really divert any savings we could have into programs for that very purpose. So, and if we save money in the long run, that's great. But if we save Alaska from more crime, that'll save us money as a safer society. So,
Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you. Just looking through the field manual for crimes. And so burglary, if someone breaks into a house, that's burglary in the first degree. That'd be a Class B felony. Is that correct?
Mr. Skidmore, are you still on with us?
Senator Carter, I am, and through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the answer to your question is yes. Burglary in the first degree is when someone enters or remains unlawfully in a dwelling or a residence with the intent to commit a crime, in this case a theft. So that would be burglary in the first, and then burglary in the second was when they enter or remain unlawfully in a building other than a dwelling.
So one of the things I've heard, one of the things I've heard from constituents is thefts from sheds, for example, or thefts, people come onto their property and steal a trailer or something. What would a theft opening up someone's shed and taking something, would that be considered burglary in the second degree? And then also, what would it be if someone came onto your property and just took, somebody down the street from me, a person just drove up and hooked their boat, the person's boat, onto their truck and tried to drive off with it. What is that a theft? How would that be classified?
The chair, Senator Wilkowski, if the person breaks into the shed, then the question becomes whether or not the shed qualifies as a building, and I'll have to look that up for you in just 1 second, so let me come back to it. But let me answer your second question first, which is if someone comes to the property and steals a boat is actually a motor vehicle, and so there could be a vehicle theft, because vehicles are considered anything that's a motorized equipment. But if you change that to, say, a bicycle, and let's assume that bicycle is of significant value, then that's simply a theft. And the significance of that distinction is a vehicle theft is automatically a Class C felony. A theft that is not of a motorized vehicle has to be determined based on the value of the property, and that was the statute I read just a few moments ago to Senator Meyer. To answer your question about the building, give me just 1 second and I'll find the definition for you to determine whether or not the shed would qualify. It can be found at Alaska Statute 1181-900, subsection B, 5. In addition to its usual meaning, includes any propelled vehicle or structure adapted for overnight accommodations by persons or carrying on business. When the building consists of separate units, including apartment units, offices, rented rooms, each unit is considered a separate building. So the answer to your question about the shed is no, it would not qualify as a burglary because it does not meet the definition of a building. So in that instance, it's just going to be a theft, which will be, the degree of that theft will be determined by the value of the property which is taken.
You might want to put rods and shed in there.
Yeah. Can I just make a statement?
I
agree completely with Senator Meyer. I mean, this is, you know, you've got the violent crime issue, which I think in large part is just most part gangs and drugs, for the most part, and drugs, alcohol. But the theft issue is huge. It's just an enormous issue. And I'm just curious how our punishments compare to other communities around the country, I guess. And because it's such a sense of being violated when somebody breaks into your house or steals something from you. And I wonder if there's maybe a few things where we just want to tick up the penalty a little bit so that we just stop what I'm seeing as really an epidemic of in this area.
So that's actually what we're trying to do right now is ratchet it up to where there's still accountability, but there's diversion capacity. And so if it's a drug issue, can they get into a drug rehab with whatever charges hanging over them. And Mr. Skidmore, and the other question probably that should be brought to light is quite often somebody being charged, it's your ability to get evidence and or the police to have a high enough charge where there's some negotiation on change of behavior, and that would be called plea bargaining, right?
So, Senator Cockhill, the analysis we go through whenever a referral comes to our office is obviously to screen that referral, that case, that investigation, to determine if there is sufficient evidence to meet the elements of a particular crime. Can we identify who actually did the conduct? Can we determine the value of the property and present evidence in court of what that market value is? Those are the things that we look at just to determine could the charge be filed, and then thereafter it's really a question of, okay, now do we have the resources to carry out this prosecution? I think that's the analysis that you're asking about. Yes. In fact, if I haven't answered your question, then please rephrase it.
No, that just shows that it's not as black and white as just putting a penalty in the statute book. That's all. I just wanted to bring that up. The other thing is, going off of what Senator Wilkowski was asking, let's just say something in a shed was meant for a person's livelihood, whether it's a chainsaw or a toolbox. Toolbox probably would be able to get up into the felony level pretty quickly, but a chainsaw probably not. So those things that are required for your livelihood, I know quite often if they're stolen, even if they're recovered, they're put into evidence. Does that ramp up the charge capacity, or is it just based on the actual item value?
Senator Cockhill, the only element found in the statutes talks about the value of the property. Let me rephrase that. The primary element found in the statutes is the value of the property. There are a few other elements that people have used. For instance, they talk about an access device, or they talk about if it's a firearm. Those are other types of property that can be taken that could elevate the crime to a higher level. But simply because the property taken is for a person's livelihood, it's the way that they earn their living, there is no description or definition or element that would fit the description you just provided. So it would simply be value under those circumstances.
Senator Wilkowski?
For Mr. Skidmore, do you find that people who commit thefts and robberies, burglaries, when they come out, do they often commit those crimes again? Or, I mean, are you seeing the same people committing the same crimes over and over again? Or, in your experience, people commit the crime, they do their time, and then they don't commit those crimes again? I mean, what I'm trying to get at is, how do we stop this? What do you think is the most effective way? Is it a longer jail sentence? Is it the rehab? And what's your sense on what we can do to break this cycle?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, you're asking the million-dollar question of how do you break that cycle, and I think it's much of what the Criminal Justice Commission and others in the criminal justice system regularly debate and talk about. If there was a golden answer, then whoever came up with it would be extremely wealthy. So I don't know that there's one simple answer to it. To come back to the first part of your question, which is, do we see people commit crimes over again? And the answer is yes, we do see people frequently come back and commit the crimes again. I think the data that the Criminal Justice Commission looked at suggested that the recidivism rate in the state of Alaska was something in the neighborhood of 66%. I certainly know from my own personal experiences that I've seen names of people that I prosecuted that come back again and again, time after time. Do I think that there's one tact versus another that necessarily works? I would tell you I think it's going to be a case-by-case analysis, a defendant-by-defendant analysis, and that's in large part why there's discretion built into our criminal justice system for both police, prosecutors, and judges. Is that each situation will have its own unique circumstances. how many times has this person been here before? What are the sorts of things that this person's dealt with in their life? What's their support system like? What, there's a whole host of factors that go into that calculus that first law enforcement looks at, and then prosecutors look at, and then judges look at in trying to decide the appropriate sentence or sanction. And as much as I'm sure any legislator would like to lock on to one single answer for everything, I respectfully, I would have to submit to you all that that's not going to exist. And that what we really have to do is design a system that has some discretion and flexibility to address those various situations, while at the same time paying attention to the statistics about what are the programs that seem to work for most people. And if you can find those, great. You fund those, you send people through those programs, but that doesn't mean that it's going to work for everyone. And you always have to keep in mind, you're never going to be able to legislate that covers every circumstance. And so you have to leave some amount of discretion for those within the system to address that on a case-by-case basis. I hope that at least in some part answers your question, sir.
Senator Wilkowski, that was part of the huge debate we had as we went through looking at how to hold people accountable and give diversionary opportunity. And I'm going to go to Senator Meyer in a second, but Renee McFarland has been online patiently listening to this. And Renee, if you have comments that you want to, that you heard some questions that you might have, add some help to some of those things. After Senator Meyer, they'll call on you, and if you want to pass, that's fine, because there'll be other opportunities. So, Senator Meyer, you had a question?
No, I think it's more of a comment, again, following up on what Senator Wilkowski was talking about and what I mentioned earlier, that we do have, and the governor mentioned as well, we do have an opioid epidemic, and I do believe that, I don't want to oversimplify our criminal activity in Anchorage or the state of Alaska, but I do believe a lot of the murders are caused by drug deals gone bad or drug dealers fighting over turf. But they only exist because there's a demand for the product. And so the people demanding the product are the users who are then breaking into our homes. So it is a it is a problem. Obviously, and I think you've been involved with this a lot longer than I, and I support rehab and treatment and any programs we can get to get people off of these addictive drugs. But obviously, you can only do that if they want help. And what I'm told is even in our corrections themselves, people are using drugs or have access to drugs. Because I've always thought, well, you know, if you put them in prison, at least then they're getting clean. But I'm not sure that's the case, because I've heard that there is still drugs fairly prevalent in our correction system, and we just don't have enough dogs to go around and sniff them out. So I think this is a very complex problem, because in order to get rid of the revolving door, you have to get rid of the demand for the product that's causing a lot of the criminal activity. And I'm just afraid that even if we can get them clean in corrections, which is a big if, and I'm hoping maybe at some point in time we can get corrections to talk to
us. That, by the way, Senator, that is my intention. Department of Corrections has been before us on implementation issues, but there's many other questions that we have before them, and we're going to be asking them to look at this. In fact, the fiscal note probably is going to be most impacted at Department of Corrections, so we'll get them before us, and we can ask these kinds of questions.
Because, Mr. Chairman, if we can get them clean in corrections and then get them through some kind of treatment or rehab after they're out of corrections, but then we just put them back in the same environment that they originally came from, then they're probably going to go back to their old ways. And so there's some way to avoid that, so we don't have the revolving door. That would be there is no silver bullet, as was said, but that would certainly, I think, go a long ways.
Yeah, much of what Senate Bill 91 set out to do is still in motion, and many of those programs and community support services and in prison programs are ramping up as we speak. So and the world, as far as I can tell, is still going to dish up the problems as fast as we can handle them. So I don't know that we're going to solve it but we still have to hold people accountable, give opportunity to change where they can. When they won't change, we have to hold them accountable at a higher level. So Renee McFarland, you've been patiently listening to this conversation, and you've heard several of the questions. Was there any of the questions that you just wanted to raise your hand and say, let me in, or do you want to pass and have that conversation later?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Renee McFarland from the Public Defender Agency. I would just clarify one thing with respect to the theft from sheds and whether it constitutes burglary or not. And that clarification would be that it really depends on the nature of the shed. The closer the shed approximates a building, it would likely qualify as a building and therefore be burglary in the second degree. So the closer your shed is to a house, the more likely it would be a burglary. The more it's just a little attachment on the side of your house, it's less likely to qualify as a building. And it's often a factual question for juries to consider.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Schilling.
Senator Jordan Schilling, for the record, just wanted to see if I could help follow up on one of Senator Wilikowski's questions earlier.
Sure.
Just about some of the research. You did ask the million-dollar question, what works to reduce crime? And I just wanted to remind the committee about the research that shows what doesn't work to reduce crime. And the commission relied heavily upon this large body of research in making its recommendations last year. And I included in my notes today, I'm glad I did, there is no significant effect of longer prison stays on recidivism rates. In other words, staying in prison slightly longer does not somehow reduce the likelihood that you'll commit crimes in the future. That said, and as the commission made clear in its report, that these recommendations are not necessarily based on a large body of research. These are in response to some of the other factors that the commission is required to consider, like community condemnation, retribution, and also just another reminder that the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, where one of many states that have entered into this process, is all about spending less money on things that don't necessarily work and aren't supported by research, and taking those savings and reinvesting them into things that actually do reduce crime, like substance abuse treatment and violence prevention and pretrial services.
The other thing that we found out from the Department of Corrections when they were talking to us about their implementation is that they took a look at the programs that they have now and found that we're over the, I think, 80-some percent effectiveness based on the Justice Reinvestment Review. So it was at least we're on the right track. Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, just one final point. And, you know, we all want this to work, and I remember we heard, you know, the way I've always described it to people, and I think recall hearing last year during the debate, was there's a certain percentage of people that you can rehabilitate and certainly want to try to rehabilitate those. There's certain people who deserve to go to jail forever. But then there's some people that you just, for whatever reason, you just cannot rehabilitate. And those are the people that I'm concerned with, because I think it's a very, very small percentage of the population that's committing these crimes. So I'm just frustrated when I read in the paper here on TV about crimes that are being committed, and you look up the person who was arrested and you'll see they've had 20, 30, 40 arrests. They've been convicted, you know, maybe a dozen or more times. And I think at some point there are people you just can't rehabilitate. And so that's what I worry about with the enactment of this Senate Bill 91 and the fixes we're making, is just there's just that small, small group of people who are committing these crimes. And all the rehabilitation in the world is just not going to rehabilitate them. And what do we do with those people? And if anybody has answers online or out there, that's maybe another million-dollar question.
Well, at least for the first time, probably starting this time next year, we'll be doing pretrial assessments, which would be looking at that. That'll be the risk level that on prior arrest will ramp up that risk level of reoffending. But we're not there yet, and we'll keep looking, Senator. With that, I'm going to adjourn the committee meeting. Thank you for the dialogue. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore and Ms. McFarland, for joining us. Jordan, you did a good job of at least laying it out for us. You can see the questions that we're going to have to deal with. And my next time that we bring this up in front of committee, we'll probably focus on those questions first so that we don't have to go through the bill over and over and over again, but really kind of work our way into where we think we can do this the best and move it on, all right? All right, with that, the Senate Judiciary Committee will adjourn.